We've got David Wilcock tonight. We're going to talk with him about Genesis and some other things when we come back. The final hour of the show, of course, always dedicated to your phone calls, and we'll do that, too, on Coast to Coast AM. And you can track David's work on his website, divinecosmos.com. David, here's a question for you.
Yes, sir, I'm here.
You believe in God?
Sure, why not? It's a big universe. There's room for God.
Well, there sure is. There sure is. So that leads me to my second question. Let's talk a little bit about Genesis. How do you interpret it? When they talk about fallen angels, who are they? What are they?
Well, this is another, I'm glad you asked that. It does tie in with what we were talking about before. I was, as I'm sure you know, George, you're in a lot of the episodes of Ancient Aliens on History Channel and H2, so
yeah.
Am I. They've come to me many, many times and asked me for information that's turned into episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I star in almost every one. And so at one point, they threw at me questions about this thing called the Book of Enoch, which I wasn't aware of before.
Really? You would not be aware of something? I find that hard to believe.
Kind of shocking, isn't it?
It is.
It's sort of like a rude slap in the face. But yes, it does happen occasionally. And then I try to correct it, so... In this case, I found out that there's this book that wasn't even identified. They found two different copies of it in Ethiopia in the 1800s, and it is literally as old as the Book of Genesis. And yet, curiously enough, it's not in the Bible. Now, why would they not want this in the Bible? Because it's talking about 13-foot-tall giants going around eating people as cannibals and being called fallen angels and cursed by God, which it actually is a plural that means Elohim or mighty ones. And that's what leads to this massive worldwide flood to basically wipe them out, which appears to be the Atlantean catastrophe. So this whole Book of Enoch kind of dovetails with the Book of Genesis in that it's the backstory leading up to Noah's flood. It actually is what occurred before Noah's flood. Noah, as it turns out, is the grandson of Enoch. And Enoch is the guy who was actually chosen by these giants, the so-called accursed fallen angels. Enoch was chosen as their representative to go to the Elohim and say, "Would you please not wipe us out?" And yet, these people, in various incarnations, in various forms, they keep getting knocked down by God or Elohim or whatever you want to call it. And that cycle is about to repeat itself yet again. So they're totally freaking out once more, and they just don't ever seem to learn their lesson.
No, I guess not. What do you think angels are?
Ultimately, I think that we're dealing with people that at one time in their universal evolution, perhaps a lot earlier than us, were like us. They were stumbling, bumbling, mumbling fools. And they grew up, and they got smart, and they got educated, and they spiritualized and made these dimensional shifts and progressed forward in their evolution to the point now where they exist in what we would think of kind of as like an energetic form. And I believe there's all different types of angelic hierarchies. That's also a very common thing in the Bibles. The Bible and other texts, you have, for example, in the Bible, angels, archangels, powers, principalities, cherubim, seraphim, this is all hierarchical of different types of beings that were freely visiting the earth, coming and going. It's amazing that all of our ancient texts describe a wide variety of different human types coming and going from the earth, and everybody writes it off as mythology. But I do not believe that's what it was.
David, I spent part of the day today with our mutual friend L.A. Marzulli. Talking with him about his Watcher series and some of his work on the trail of the Nephilim. Of course, in Genesis, we talk about the Nephilim, where they're apparently the offspring of those who came down and mated with the earth women. And then, of course, they were giants themselves. Have you done much work into that area of giants?
I have done a lot more lately, and it is a very, very significant subject, and it's a subject that is so significant that it's probably going to be one of the databanks that feeds into my next book, because I think that for people in this field of paranormal research, there's been so much retread over the same old ground, same old data. I'm always looking for the story. I'm looking for something new, something exciting.
Yeah.
And I love it when we can find data. Well, the amount of cover-up of the discovery of giant human remains, I mean, George, you live in L.A. too. We can look right out there and see Catalina Island, where 3,784 giant skeletons were found in an archaeological dig in 1926.
Apparently so, with pictures, and everything was confiscated.
Everything got swept under the rug. Oh, give it to the Smithsonian. They'll put it on reserve. Well, where have we heard that word?
They must have one heck of a basement. I'd like to be down there.
You never see it again. And, you know, there's also a very interesting phenomenon of stasis beings. Apparently, people came here a long, long, long time ago and had advanced technology that creates a time bubble. And if you get inside the time bubble, sometimes they build it into like a sarcophagus shape, or sometimes they build it into like a stone tablet, then you can literally just kind of edit out 500 years, and for you it's only like a day or two has gone by, and just, you know, jump back out again 500 years later, check it out, see how things are going. If you don't like it, get back in again.
Do you think Goliath was one of these Nephilim?
Absolutely. Goliath had three other giants that he was also living with, and they were all hunted down by King David and his associates and wiped out. These people were real trouble. I mean, look, you got...
They're cannibals, weren't they?
Yeah, you got legends on both sides of the Atlantic about giants. You've got many, many thousands of sites where they've been located. And interestingly enough, the giant skeletons are almost always found in or near earth mounds. So it's not just any old places. It's these places that at one time looked like pyramids or cones, or like Serpent Mound in Ohio is actually in the shape of a snake with the all-seeing eye at the front. Those are not just earthworks. Those are actually burial sites, and you go inside them, and you find all these giants. And another tasty bit of disclosure I'll give you and your audience is that Canada is way, way, way bigger than the U.S. Just the bottom four provinces, Alberta, Ontario, et cetera, those areas alone are as big as the U.S., but then above all that, you got the Northwest Territory, which is huge. Well, almost everybody in Canada lives 90 miles or less above the American border because it's too freaking cold to go up there. I have heard now from the insiders there are tons and tons and tons of mound builder sites that were found in Canada. And so what do? They build like a fake nuclear power plant or a building over the top of it. And then right inside that building, they got the mound, and they can do the research in secret. And a lot of these mounds apparently, well, not a lot, but there are at least 26 or 50 some, somewhere between 25 and 50 of these stasis beings that have been found where these people are still alive in some kind of time bubble that you can't get through. And they're waiting for something to be reawakened. And two different groups have recently been reawakened. One of them was a 24-foot-tall giant human, and the other one was a group of 56 people who just woke up last week. And apparently there's some sort of frequency change in our solar system that the stasis is programmed to shut down when that change is about to occur. And guess what? All the stasis beings are waking up now. So it's a very interesting thing going on.
Why hide the results of these giants? What are they afraid of?
Well, first of all, they have towering size. It would be a total glitch in the matrix to have any of these people make it out. And even for their size, apparently, they have vastly superhuman strength compared to us. So imagine if you have a 24-foot-tall human who, for his size, is much, much stronger than a normal human would be if they were 24 feet tall. And he takes a look around and says, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this junk. I expected to come into a really cool futuristic world, and these people are driving around in pollution-spitting, gasoline-burning automobiles. I'm pissed off. I'm going to go smash some things up. That's what they're worried about. So when these stasis beings start to wake up, there's a huge, huge military lockdown around the facility. They got guns everywhere, missiles and bombs, and they're going to make sure that these people are not going to get out into the open. And apparently what I've been hearing is that it's one strain of Nordic ETs that's now taking these stasis beings off planet when they wake up and bring them to others like them, where these new guys are now venerated for, you know, having been asleep for 13,000 years, and now they've awakened, and so that's kind of like a heroic big deal for others of their kind who are still living in other colonies. I know it sounds all crazy. It sounds like I'm totally crazy, but...
No, not at all. Now let's move into Revelation.
Not at all, he says.
End times.
All right.
Do you believe we're in end times now?
Absolutely. You got to understand, George, and I've said this on your show before, we could go back and reference specific episodes where I, and even that show that I had with you on Beyond Belief. Look, there's over 30 different ancient prophecies, basically everything from Polynesian islands in the Pacific to Druid prophecies, Buddhist prophecies, Muslim. Go into the Quran, read what that says. Everybody talks about this. It's not just the Bible. Everybody. Zoroastrian prophecy from Iran, Hindu prophecy from India, you name it, they've got it. Over 30 different sources all say the planet goes into a crazy, crazy crisis, and then kaboom, we get blown into this golden age. And there's some sort of cracking of the shell that's involved. It's like this worldwide, almost like if you throw up, you'll feel better kind of phenomenon that's happening. And we're still in the vomiting part, but the part afterwards is, wow, now I feel pretty good. Hmm. So I think we're not quite there yet.
Who is the Antichrist, David?
That is another very interesting question. And in order to give what I would feel would be the most spiritually correct answer, I'd go back to Edgar Cayce's work and say that they describe in the Edgar Cayce readings the Antichrist as a principle of selfishness, manipulation, and control over others, service to self, basically, and that it can awaken within individuals, within groups, and even within nations. And so I think that, and this is going to get a little cosmic for a second, but everything else I'm saying is anyway, I think every person right now, and this might sound too grandiose to handle, but I think every person is being faced with a choice. Are you going to be the Messiah or the Antichrist in the way that you're thinking and in the way that you're acting and in the way that you treat other people? And if you frame it in that kind of a cosmic context, it starts to make sense, because if you go back to what Jordan Maxwell's research has said about the Hebrew Bible, the word Messiah or Meshiach is actually a plural, and it's everybody who's awakening. So I think the Antichrist could be anybody, and I think the Messiah could be anybody. It depends on the choices you're making.
Do you think the Antichrist is born already here?
I think there's lots and lots of people embodying that archetype right now. Absolutely. And I've heard other insiders tell me all kinds of speculations about Antichrist could be this, Antichrist could be that. I've heard, I don't want to name people, but I've heard, you know, oh, the Antichrist is so-and-so or such-and-such. And, you know, I think that's kind of like comic book metaphysics to try to pin it down to one person. I think really we're dealing with archetypes here. And also, everybody's a shade of gray. There's really no pure white person and there's no pure black person in terms of spiritual polarity. I think that nobody's a savior. Don't expect somebody else to come and save you. This is, you got to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. Self-responsibility and integrity are so important right now. And everybody wants to have somebody else do the hard work. Well, put Jesus up on the cross. He'll die for our sins. I'm not knocking Christianity, but if you actually read what Jesus said, John 14:12, he says, as I do these things, you shall do these things and greater things, for I go unto my Father. So bearing that in mind, and again, I'm not a Bible thumper. I can quote any scripture you want, but here's a good piece of software Jesus gave us. You really understand what he's saying. He was merely going up and being crucified to show us the archetype of the hero's journey, which is written into everyone as the hero. We are all the hero awakening, and the crucifixion is ultimately a symbol of the loss of the ego, the giving up of the attachment to things and to, you know, the gratification of our personality in favor of a higher calling. That's what we're really here for.
The Antichrist, who is going to trick people, doesn't know that he or she is that right now at this point, assuming they're here.
Well, again, we're back to the idea that it might be one person.
Right.
I think
I come from that end.
You know, look, I've heard different insiders swear that the Antichrist is this guy or that guy or this person. Okay, I'm not going to name those names. It would be very perfunctory for me to do that in terms of, like, I don't want to pass judgment on somebody. I don't know what's going on. I don't know if this person would show up in any big cosmic obvious way. But I do think that if you want to look at that as sort of like a crayon line drawing of something that's true, that there's a lot of people in what we could call the Illuminati or the Cabal who are now starting to realize, hey, we might not be the good guys. And in fact, the younger Cabal, from what I'm hearing, there's a huge split now between the younger Cabal and the older Cabal, because the younger Cabal is saying, we don't want any part of this stuff of trying to, like, wipe everybody out. And they're cutting deals left and right. There's a big, big alliance centered in Russia, Brazil, India, China, South Africa, et cetera, BRICS. And the BRICS alliance has ganged up on the Illuminati, and they are bringing them down. They're starting an alternate banking system. They're creating, you know, all kinds of information leaks. It's just the boat is springing water out of its hull in every direction, and it's going to sink. And let's just hope that we still have some kind of dollars that we can spend on the way down, because it's not going to be good for the American economy as this happens. There is going to be some pretty nasty stuff coming up our way pretty soon here.
How bad?
You know, I hear that there's two camps. One says they want to devalue the dollar by 60% right away. The other one says we want to do it in four tranches of 15% each, spread it out over a few years. I don't know what they're going to do, but I think that when we go into this new financial system, we are going to get a nice, quick kick in the pants for a while. And I think it's probably inevitable, but, you know, if they do too much of that, then it's going to destabilize the country, and that could cause all kinds of humanitarian problems, and I know that the people in the alliance do not want that to happen. The people in the Cabal try to tell their own members, oh, these alliance people want to drive America into starvation. They want the whole world to hate us. They want everybody to try to blow us up. That's not true, not from what I'm hearing. The alliance has been very, very careful to not use violence, to not use false flag terrorism against us. They're just trying to free America from the people who are enslaving us. And I think it's a valiant work that they're doing. And more now, everybody's going on their side, and that includes allies that they have out in space fighting this cosmic battle for Earth's freedom as well. There's all kinds of stuff going on right now. It's a very fascinating time.
It's a good time.
I believe that, yes. I mean, I've been holding my tongue, George. There's a whole lot of stuff going on that I could be talking about, but this is a shooting war. There are people giving me information, and if I say too much of what they're telling me, they will be shot dead. And I take this very seriously. And, you know, people can, in the comfort of their own home, with a bong on one side and a laptop on the other, they can write whatever hate about me they want, but this is frickin' real. And I'm on the front line fighting this battle day after day, and it sucks.
You're not alone, though, David.
Yeah, I'm doing the best I can. And George, I mean, you're up every night on the air talking to people, and it's a wonderful service. And if people are listening to this and saying, well, I only listen when David's on, you really ought to check out Coast to Coast. I mean, how do you do it, George? How do you stay up every night and keep talking to so many people? It's amazing.
It's what I do, David.
Well, you've done great, and I'm really proud of you, buddy.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment, and I want to talk with you about a subject, David, I've never talked with you about. Life after death. That'll be next with David Wilcock on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Wilcock with us. We'll take your phone calls with David next hour. David, life after death.
I believe it's real, and furthermore, I believe there's extensive and irrefutable scientific evidence to prove that it's real. And this goes all the way back to Dr. Raymond Moody's seminal work, Life After Life, in 1976, with data that still cannot be refuted. It can only be shamed or attacked on the basis of ad hominem, you know, character assassination of the people that have tried to come up with this stuff, but clinical death has very strict guidelines. You have cessation of heart rate, cessation of respiratory breathing, and cessation of brainwave electrical activity. You have those three things, you have what's called clinical death, which means the person is no longer alive. Innumerable cases exist of people who are in a state of clinical death and report observations in the operating room, hearing conversations of things they could not have heard in a dead body, and many people report going through a tunnel, many people report ending up in a field or some other type of beautiful location, seeing people they knew who were alive before but are not alive now, welcoming them, and then they're usually told that you have to come back. There's a very consistent path. It doesn't matter what religion you're in, what country you're from, everybody is basically getting the same type of experiences, and Dr. Michael Newton actually broke it down to the degree where he's got a complete list of what people go through step by step, and anybody that's having a near-death experience, he can figure out where they are in that 10-step process just by asking them questions. So these are thousands of different cases that have all been correlated together, people who are atheists, people who don't know anything about this stuff. It turns out that everybody is a spiritual being. Everybody is here on a mission. You incarnate into a physical body because you want to learn something, and then we forget it, and it's like the prodigal son archetype. We wander away from home. We say, well, Dad doesn't want me to come home. He thinks I'm a jerk. But then eventually there's a tearful reunion with your family, and you find out that you were welcomed to come home anytime you wanted the whole time.
And with this belief in the afterlife, you don't have to be necessarily religious, do you?
No. Like I said, anybody that is hypnotized, and they're hypnotized deeply enough where you start to be able to recall the life between lives, they all report exactly the same series of steps that they go through in the same sequence. Doesn't matter what culture, what religion, what race, atheist, you know, you name it. Everybody has the same experiences. And if you have somebody who's educated and understands what these stages are, they can start to ask questions and, you know, without having to steer the investigation, they know where things are going to go and they can, you know what to ask as depending on which stage people are in. And this is where we find out that you have a soul group that you incarnate with in lifetime after lifetime, and they all come out in different guises. So somebody who's your family member in one lifetime might be your friend in another, but it's the same small group of people that keeps shuffling around in different configurations lifetime after lifetime, learning from each other. And we together plan out what we're going to do before we ever get here, and we set up signposts and little synchronicities, and the major events that happen in our lives are chosen before we ever incarnate, and the whole reason why we're here is that the world is a vast illusion intended to teach us the truth about who and what we really are.
The Akashic Records, do you think they're real?
Absolutely. It's a term that was coined originally in, it's a Sanskrit word, Akasha or Akashic, and it goes all the way back to, again, Hindu and Zoroastrian mythology. The word was then used again in the Casey readings, which is where a lot of people are now familiar with it. And the concept there essentially gets back to the idea that time is not linear, and therefore all events that would have been, could have been, did occur in some or another layers of time can all be accessed and reviewed. And this is not only things that already happened, but things that would be, could be, should be in the future, depending on which layer we snap onto. Because all the probabilities exist. The ways that things can go already exist. But I will also say there are certain nexus points or knots in time where regardless of which timeline you happen to be on, you're still going to hit the same nexus. It's just a question of how you get there.
Well, how do you get there without help?
The wheels of time will naturally click forward, and eventually the bell rings. And the bell is getting pretty close to ringing now, so
yeah.
It's a very interesting time.
These are, as they used to say, the best of times, the worst of times, David.
Tale of Two Cities has never been more correct. It's, as you mentioned Richard Hoagland earlier, his famous quote, the good are getting better and the bad are getting worse. Boy, if that isn't becoming increasingly clear.
And the gap gets wider, too.
Well, what that's called is polarization, and it allows for you, as the seeker of truth, which I believe most people on your show are.
Yes, they are.
To make a decision. Do you want to be like that, or do you want to be an ethical, responsible person? Do you want to be a manipulator and a controller, or do you want to uplift others so that they feel blessed and happy after they've come in contact with you? I mean, this is going to sound corny for some, but my whole life, if I go to the gas station or I meet somebody at the checkout counter, I treat them like they're my best friend. And, George, you've seen me work the crowds.
I mean, yes,
you know,
I
this
do.
Is how I go.
They love you.
And why not? Why would you want to do anything other than that? Once you understand what the universe really is and what your job here is, your job is to be a loving person. Your job is to try to make the planet a better place. And that's all you have to do. It's really simple. There's no, you know, when I used to do psychic readings professionally from 98 to 2005, I had a 99.9% success rate. I'd go into a deep state of trance just like Casey, speak very rapidly. You transcribe it, it's perfect. And it would. There was a lady who actually had written all these songs, and the reading was quoting her song lyrics and telling her what they meant. And she's like all crying and sobbing. I'd say about half the people I did this for would be totally sobbing on the phone while I'm doing this. And I'd have to learn not to let that interrupt the trance state. So I did this for probably 500 clients is what I counted based on the cassettes that I have, because I have all the cassettes still archived. The only people that didn't like it were people who got too much of the truth at once. But the reason why I'm bringing this up right now is I would go into the dreams before I had the session. I'd dream people's dreams the morning of, and I wouldn't see it as, okay, there's that guy over there who's my client. I would jump into his skin, and I would live his karma as if it was my own. Just like they say in the Hindu tradition, the guru takes on your karma. Well, I lived that stuff, and that's why I ultimately had to stop doing it, because I started to feel like the revolving door at the front of a corporate office building. Like, where is my identity here? I'm jumping into other people's lives. I'm experiencing their deepest, darkest fears, terrible abuse that happened to them, terrible abuse they did to others. I have to forgive myself for things that I didn't actually do. And then I'd start telling them this on the phone. They start sobbing. And this was like what I was doing every day. You know, I did this job probably 4 clients a week, 3 weeks out of the month. And, you know, it was crazy. But the point is, I had firsthand experience in seeing these dreams come in for my clients where it wasn't me. I wasn't looking at them saying, that's somebody else. I was living their life. So therefore, I've had this flexibility of identity in which I jump into other people like a chameleon. And if I can do that, I believe everybody does that. And I believe, therefore, if you're making somebody else happy, you are improving the quality of your own life directly, because we're all ultimately sharing consciousness together.
So if you believe in life after death, and of course you believe in reincarnation, because you may be Edgar Casey, where do demons fit in on this and evil?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that the answer is unconventional. It's probably not what various religious people would think I'm going to say, but I'll give it to you. My core spiritual philosophy is the Law of One series. The reason why I use it is because there's hundreds and hundreds of different scientific data points that I've been able to independently verify with empirical data that came out after the books were written between 1981 and 1983. That's proof. That's validation for me. So then that makes me more open to the philosophy that it gives, which, incidentally, is very similar to the greatest mystery teachings of the Eastern religions, the stuff that you only get when you've been meditating for 20 years, and then they bring out this dusty old scroll that's really got the good stuff. All that stuff was already in the Law of One. So what do they say about demons? What they say is that the universe will have angelic beings who send you positive energy when you have positive thoughts, and negative beings are allowed to send you negative energy when you have negative thoughts. So whenever you're going in a positive direction, you'll get energy that strengthens that direction, and vice versa with the negative side. So the negative entities are out there, and they were allowed to exist by a loving, benevolent universe, because if you ask a Christian, is God all there is? Of course. Then who made Satan? Well, God. So isn't Satan a part of God? Isn't Satan actually part of God's working mechanism? Then they start hemming and hawing. I don't know. Satan is this bad, bad thing. We can't talk about Satan. Well, no, the negative is allowed to occur. The negative is allowed to exist because the force of evil interferes with our free will. It disrupts our free will, which ultimately they have to pay that back. That's a karmic debt that they have to pay back. But in the process, when your walls are shattered and your store is vandalized and you have to rebuild, that forces you out of a loop that you could get stuck in as a culture in some cases for thousands of years. It forces you to move. It forces you to grow. It forces you to think differently. It forces you to go back to school to get new skills. And I'm kind of analogizing this to a personal level of somebody owning a store, but it can happen in terms of many, many cultures that have had harmony for thousands of years, but they're still living in a primitive tribal environment, which is fine in one level, but on another level, they're never going to grow unless they get invaded. And again, to some degree, this is allowed to occur because we need to have the ground periodically get tilled so that new crops can be planted and new seeds will germinate and we get new fruit. And people continue to grow more intelligent, more sophisticated. And yet what's happening is there's a lot of pain with that wheel of karma. And we are now at the point where I believe on a planetary level that we have reached the apex of the bad stuff and it's all coming to an end. We're not going to have to keep going through this anymore to learn to love each other. We learn the lesson. We stop the suffering.
Thank gosh. Now, who are the progenitors?
The progenitors are the 70-foot-tall extraterrestrials that apparently came to our solar system 5 million years ago, colonizing it from the outside in, starting with the Oort cloud and the moons of the gas giant planets and working their way in. They are, as I said, refugees from an interplanetary war. They were supposedly coming here as prisoners, kind of in like their own version of a rehab, and all they wanted to do is keep fighting more wars. But the cool part is that they had very advanced technology, and they've left tons of ruins behind. And when I did my talk at the Conscious Life Expo, I gave all kinds of photographic evidence of very strange stuff, including moons around some of the gas giants that they call a Pac-Man formation because it literally, the heat signature of these moons looks like Pac-Man. What do I mean by that? Okay, normally, the side of the moon that faces the planet should be the hottest part. That makes sense because
you would think so.
The planet is warmer. Instead, what we see is this Pac-Man shape, which literally looks like the Pac-Man character, but that's exactly the wrong type of heat distribution that we would think. It appears that some of the moons in our solar system have an entire civilization built inside of them, and you can fly inside, and there's grass, and there's trees, and there's animals, and there's atmosphere, and there's buildings, and vehicles flying through the air, and lots of people living out their lives, having warm, sunny days, and you'd never know it. From the outside, it's cloaked. It looks just like a moon. And so the Pac-Man is actually the heat signature of where those cities are. And the people in the space program have told me there are certain parts of our solar system they're not allowed by treaty to fly through. They're not allowed to go near those.
And they abide by that?
They have to. Yeah, because if you get too close, guess what?
Extinguish time.
You got it.
So when you've looked at some of the UFO cases here in this country, what do you think of the ones where they shut down our missile silos?
Very good question. There was, you know, the key guy who kind of had this all cluster around him and became like the new Dr. Stephen Greer was Robert Hastings.
That's right.
You probably had him on your show.
Yes.
And he did an amazing conference in 2011 where he brought together a multiplicity of witnesses to this phenomenon. And what we take away from this is that the benevolent ETs, the angels, if you will, have made it absolutely impossible for the planetary elite to create any type of large-scale nuclear holocaust. They did allow some small ones to happen. They did allow Hiroshima and Nagasaki to happen, only to show us how horrible this was at a time where we had weapons that were equivalent to a BB gun or a pea shooter compared to the kind of stuff we got now. But, you know, kids who are millennials do not remember, George, what guys like you and I were going through, where it was U.S. versus USSR, and we didn't know but what we were going to become hash browns tomorrow. You know, the whole 80s, it's like, what the heck was that all about? You know, people were really worried that there was going to be a nuclear war. And here's the trick. The planetary elite wanted to have a nuclear war because they'd already built 225 cities underground that hold 65,000 people each. They fire off the ordnance with the nuclear subs, and then the breeder reactors and nuclear subs dock into the underground city and then become a power source for the city. So the sub still has usefulness after it fires off its missiles. They were planning on destroying the planet and hiding out underground, and they are not going to be allowed to do that.
Well, that's a good thing.
Absolutely. We are being protected. This is a spiritual illusion that we live in. The planetary elite, cabal, Illuminati, whatever you want to call them, they're only allowed to do the things that they do, like children in the sandbox who don't realize that there are monitors walking around the outside of the sandbox. It's a very similar situation. So every country that's got nuclear capability, China, Russia, you name it, they've all had severe problems with ET interference completely melting down the warheads of their missiles. And when you talk to people high enough up in this game, you find out that this has happened over and over again, that when these UFOs go by, the missiles are ruined. They're completely taken offline. And in fact, it's so severe now, especially there was, I now found out recently, that the most recent time it happened was in 2003, thereabouts. It's so severe now that actually nobody even has nukes anymore because they're not even allowed to keep them. They just get them melted down. So the whole thing is now a big con job. We're not going to have a nuclear war. It's just not going to happen.
I hope you're right there.
Yep.
I still think someone's going to slip up.
From what I can tell, it's almost impossible. It would be such a minute chance that it's, you know, like fractions of a decimal point likely to ever happen of percentage points.
Fallout from Fukushima. I've got a minute left. Have you heard anything?
There is all kinds of classified exotic technology that's being used to put a containment bubble around that and to deradiate what's coming out. So I really don't think that that's going to be anywhere near as bad as the prognostications are, including the fact that the half-life of the cesium that dumped into the ocean, most of it becomes benign after about a year and a half. That's not what a lot of these fear porn people are saying, but if you actually do the homework, that's what my conclusion is, so I don't worry about Fukushima.
All right, David, stay with us. We're going to come back. Final hour to go here with David Wilcock. That means your phone calls here on Coast to Coast. Questions, stories, answers, you name it. We'll have it for you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM.